You're listening to the Locked In Podcast. Here's your host, Algernon Cash.
I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. We are in the middle of the 2022 midterm election cycle. We've been having some really great guests on the last several weeks talking about the election cycle. Obviously, the conversation has been more focused on the primary election cycle, which is now behind us. So we already knew, everybody pretty much knew, that Justice Sherry Beasley would be the Democratic nominee for the United States Senate in November. And we now know that Congressman Ted Budd will be the Republican nominee at the top of the ticket going into November. I know for many of you, you were not surprised by this. We talked about this on the show with John Hood prior to the election or voting day. But I think many of us, including myself, was surprised by the margin. You know, Congressman Budd took almost nearly 60% of the vote and handedly beat former Governor Pat McCrory, as well as former Congressman Mark Walker. There were a ton of people in that race in that field. So it was really surprising that Congressman Budd was able to take almost 60% of the vote. Today, I have with me Mitch Kokai, who is the senior political analyst with the John Locke Foundation. He knows all things politics here in North Carolina. I am so honored to be able to call him a friend. I've known him for a very long time. And so I've invited him here to lock in with us today and share some thoughts about what's going on with politics here in North Carolina. Mitch, thank you for locking in with me, man.
Well, happy to be here and thank you for the invitation. I don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. So I don't know everything about politics, but I know enough that we should make it kind of interesting anyway.
Well, you know, let's start with my introduction. I mean, we're coming off of a primary day. We all knew that Sherry Beasley was the presumptive nominee, so no surprises on the Democratic side. Most of us thought, especially going into the last few weeks of the primary election cycle, that, you know, Ted Budd was surging. He obviously got the Trump endorsement. He also got the lieutenant governor's endorsement here in the 11th hour. But he also had about $14 million come into the state from Club for Growth. What were your thoughts about the race? I mean, any surprises for you?
I think, like you, the big surprise for me was the ultimate margin. Now, folks who might remember from earlier in the year, they saw that despite the fact that Ted Budd had President Trump's endorsement going back to last summer, by the start of the year, that really hadn't made him a front runner in the race. Most of the polls were showing former Governor Pat McCrory still in the lead, although it wasn't a huge lead, and Ted Budd was behind. And for the chattering classes, there was even some discussion earlier this year that, well, perhaps this was a dud endorsement and Ted Budd was not going to be able to overcome Pat McCrory. But we saw that as time went on and as that money from Club for Growth came in and not only pushed Ted Budd forward as the candidate of choice for President Trump, but also a lot of ads really trashing the record as governor of Pat McCrory, that helped Ted Budd. We saw by April that Budd had a pretty significant lead, double digits in a lot of the polls. And then the late polls right before the election showed him having 28 point lead. And I think a lot of people thought, well, that's probably overstating it. But then we saw as the election returns came in that actually understated it. He won by 34 points. That was a surprise to me. It also was a bit of a surprise to me that former Congressman Mark Walker, who had been doing not well in the polls, but certainly in the neighborhood of 12 to 14%, ended up down around 9%. And what that says to me is that while a lot of people in looking at the candidates thought that Mark Walker might be a good choice, once they got to the ballot box and finally decided they wanted to cast a vote for someone they thought could win, that some of those votes either went to Ted Budd or went to Pat McCrory. And that's probably what knocked former Congressman Walker's numbers down. And probably many of those, if not most of those folks who said they would prefer Mark Walker, ended up going to Ted Budd. And that was probably why he ended up with a higher margin than what we expected. As you said, on the Democratic side, no surprise, more than 80% for former Chief Justice Sherry Beasley. I think if she had been down below 70%, it would have been a shock because no one else in that race, and there were a bunch of candidates, but no one else in that race had done anything on TV. It had really made much of a peep. The major contenders on the Democratic side decided to stay out. And the ones who had gotten into the race got out of the race as soon as Sherry Beasley was in. So, and now it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen with Ted Budd and Sherry Beasley in the general election. I can't share all the details, but I have seen some polling information that's going to be out later this week that will suggest that it's going to be a tough race. I mean, neither one has a major advantage at this point, and a lot can happen between now and November.
You know, you made some comments about former Congressman Mark Walker, and you know, my audience knows him well because he's a personal friend of mine. He's been on the show several times. You know, I was really torn, Mitch. You know, sometimes you can have too many friends. And Ted Budd was a friend. You know, I'd actually been appointed to a commission by Governor McCrory, so there was a little bit of loyalty to him as well. So it was a really, really tough choice for me as I went into the voting booth. However, to your point, I was surprised that Congressman Walker didn't perform a little bit better. I thought he would have did maybe 4 or 5 more points, you know, in the race. But to your point, I had Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson on. And when I asked him about why he made the endorsement that he made, because everybody knows that Mark Robinson and Mark Walker are great friends, he said at the end of the day, it came down to who could actually win. And he said that's why he went with Budd over Walker. And I like the way you just summarized how voters might have been thinking when they went in the voting booth. As much as they may like Walker, it came down to, okay, who's going to win and who's viable? And a lot of that support flowed to Budd. Now, you know, I'm happy for Congressman Budd. I text him right away and say congratulations. You know, my audience knows how I feel about this. I'm happy for him, but I didn't like the way he did it. And I didn't agree with the not coming out for debates. You know, I watched the debate that was hosted by Carolina Journal. You guys did a great job. I just felt like, you know, Congressman Budd should have came out at least one time to debate so he could defend his ideas and really show the voting public how bad he wanted to go, you know, be in Washington as their senator. Is that type of strategy going to work against Justice Beasley in the fall?
I think it's going to be very interesting. This election cycle has certainly caused some problems for the future of political debates because we saw it in this race. Sherry Beasley didn't really have the competition that would have forced her to be in a debate, but she really wasn't in any debates. Ted Budd, as you just mentioned, decided to sit out any debate, and there were quite a few that he could have been involved in. Now, with our debate, one of the official explanations of why he didn't take part was by that point, all of the candidates were not necessarily decided, and so it wasn't certain who all was going to be on the ballot, and his handlers told us that that was the reason that he sat out. But certainly, after all of the candidate filing was done, there were plenty more debates that he could take part in, and he didn't. But it didn't hurt him, as you said, close to 60% of the vote. We also saw that in some congressional races. There is a very hotly contested district here in the Triangle, the 13th district, which is really the only true toss-up district among the new congressional districts. And on the Republican side, there was a candidate who, once again, like Representative Budd, was the Trump endorsed candidate, Beau Hinds, and he didn't want to take part in any debates either. In fact, he showed up to one debate, looked around, and then left. And his answer to those who asked him about it was he had to go to another event. But some thought, well, he just decided he didn't want to take part in a debate and didn't think he had to. And he ended up winning. He got more than 30% of the vote in the primary. So I think it's going to be interesting to see whether this becomes a strategy for the future, that if you are a candidate, you're a front runner, and you have something that is like a Trump endorsement in that it's something that's going to give you a real leg up on the competition, plus you have a lot of money behind you, do you decide, hey, a debate can only hurt me, it can't help me, I'm not going to take part? I think if more people decide to do that, that's going to be a bad sign for transparency, for getting the ideas out, and for testing candidates. Because remember, one of the things about a debate is that it helps test the candidate. And if people get a candidate gets up there, can't really express his or her ideas very well or comes across poorly, we need to know that. We need to know that before they run. We need to know that before they're in office, because if they can't handle a debate, how are they going to handle all of those difficult decisions they'll have to make once they're in office?
No, I totally agree. I'm a student of the game. I love politics, but I also love the process. And I think the debating part of the process, or that component, is so critically important, like you said, to get you ready. But to also know, who are we sending to Washington? Who do you really represent our interests? Do you have the fight to be able to go up there and do what you say you're going to do? So, yes, I think this would have been a great time for Bud to practice, because now he's going to be going up against a trained litigator, a former justice. And you'd like to believe that she's going to do pretty well at being able to articulate her ideas. You talked about the former president. I think many of us, again, I knew Trump still had a firm grip on the party. I really didn't understand the depth of that grip until after primary day. And there's been some polls that have come out that say, you know, former President Trump is still polling at 70 or sometimes over 70% within the Republican Party. So he still has an incredible amount of influence. One race where he did endorse a candidate, Madison Cawthorn, Madison actually lost his primary. You know, Mitch, does that speak to Trump's influence, or does that just speak to Madison's baggage?
Well, I think having the endorsement from the former president was probably something that helped push Madison Cawthorn further than he would have otherwise. Folks who didn't follow the numbers very closely should know that Cawthorn, had he been the top-ranked candidate, would have had enough votes to win his primary. He was well over 30%. But State Senator Chuck Edwards was a percentage or a couple of percentage points ahead of him. And Senator Edwards had the backing from all of the top Republican legislative leaders and Senator Tom Tillis and basically most of the Republican Party establishment. I think if there had been a few fewer candidates in that race, because there were a bunch of people running against Madison Cawthorn, you might have seen an even larger spread between Chuck Edwards and Madison Cawthorn. Obviously, Representative Cawthorn is a story in and of himself. It's not just a case of him espousing some views that some would see as further right than the electorate. No, he has all kinds of self-inflicted wounds of bizarre videos and photos, getting arrested, having a gun at the airport, speeding a lot of times, getting investigated for insider trading and for paying a lot for his friend to be one of his assistants. There are all kinds of issues with Representative Cawthorn. And it was interesting to see President Trump, former President Trump, come out and say, look, I know he has these problems. Give him a second chance. My guess is that it helped Representative Cawthorn a bit, but not enough. And it shows that if people are united behind an alternative to the Trump candidate, that can help. Now, I mentioned earlier in the Beau Hines race here in the 13th district, he got 32% of the vote, and the second place candidate, I believe, was at about 27-28%. There were in that race multiple candidates. I think if there had been one main anti-Hines or anybody but Hines candidate, might have turned out differently. It might have been more like that the 11th district out there, where people would have galvanized behind the other candidate, because most of the other candidates were actually from the area. Beau Hines was from your area, the Triad, and decided to come to the Triangle just because that seemed like a good place to run. I think if people had galvanized behind one non-Hines candidate, it might have turned out in a similar way to the Cawthorn race. So the former president certainly has a sway here. We saw that with Ted Budd. We saw that with Beau Hines. We saw it to some extent with Madison Cawthorn. But it's not the be-all, end-all. There are other factors involved.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you bring in the amount of money that Budd had come in his race, the $14 million from Club for Growth, I mean, that makes it incredibly difficult. And then, you know, I do think the lieutenant governor, who polls very well within the Republican base and the conservative, you know, conservative base of the party, his endorsement, I think, also put more, you know, air in his sails as well as he was getting into primary day. So I think you're right. You know, real quick
and,
question.
And Algernon, it was not just the fact that Lieutenant Governor came out and endorsed Bud, but he also in that same ad said, Pat McCrory's not a conservative. To me, that was sort of the nail in the coffin in that ad. It wasn't just, hey, vote for Bud. I like him. He's the best candidate. He also came out and said, as the highest polling conservative in North Carolina right now, that he didn't believe that Pat McCrory was conservative.
Yeah, and that triggered John Hood to write a piece that I actually enjoyed reading as well. You had a piece in the Carolina Journal that talked about the change, the 2017 change to election laws that allowed for primary elections to be determined at the 30% threshold versus the 40% threshold. You know, if that change hadn't occurred, what would that mean for Madison Cawthorn today?
I think in the Cawthorn race, probably not a huge difference. He would have been able to ask for a primary runoff, and he would have run off against Chuck Edwards. I think Cawthorn is probably close to his ceiling. So he was at the lower 30s. He might have been able to get to 40 or low 40s, but probably still would have lost. But I think in some of the other cases, it could have been different. I think in the Hines case, as I just mentioned, people who were against having someone coming from outside of the area to run, who didn't have a whole lot of political experience, was a younger fellow, they might have galvanized behind the second place candidate calling for the runoff, and you could have seen a different nominee. I think the same thing could have happened in the first district, where you had a really nasty fight between two people named Sandy Smith, who was the 2000 or who was the 2020 nominee running against G.K. Butterfield, and Sandy Robertson, the mayor of Rocky Mount. That was very close. Sandy Smith won with about 31% of the vote, but she had a lot of negative baggage that came out in some of the campaign ads. And I think if that had gone to a runoff, that might have been the case where the second place finisher was able to get above the first place finisher. And there were a couple of other races where that may have played a part as well. One of the interesting things about this, and as a student of political history, I'm sure that you know this or may say, oh, yeah, I had forgotten about that, but that was true, is that for years and years, what happened in North Carolina was that in a primary race, you had to win 50%. You had to get a majority or it would go to a runoff. And then the reason that changed in the late 80s was that there were a couple of high-profile African-American candidates who won the plurality on the Democratic side in the first runoff, but then got beat won in the first primary, but got beat in the runoff. And there was a sense that, you know, this is something that's kind of bad news, that these candidates who are strong candidates are losing in this primary runoff, and some tied it back to the way that this primary runoff was put together in the first place as an era of the Jim Crow era. And so in 1989, the General Assembly changed the law so that you could win by getting a substantial plurality, which at that time was 40%. And so we had the 40% standard for about 30 years, and now it's down to 30%. And I think a lot of people are probably happy that we don't have to go to a bunch of congressional primary runoffs and go through all that time and expense. Now these candidates could focus on running in November.
You spoke a little bit about the allegation from Lieutenant Governor Robinson about former Governor Pat McCrory just not being conservative enough. And he actually stated that here on my show, and I challenged him because, you know, a lot of these big economic development announcements that we've heard about around the state, whether it's Nucor down in Lexington or Macy's in Salisbury or Boom coming to Greensboro or Toyota coming to Randolph County and VinFast coming to Chatham County. A lot of this economic development is in my opinion, was rooted in the McCrory administration and some of the work that Sharon Decker was doing when she was Commerce Secretary. And then also some of the engagement that McCrory had with people like Jim Melvin right here in Greensboro in the central part of the state. Of course, the lieutenant governor says that's not conservative enough. McCrory has a piece, well, he didn't write a piece, but he was interviewed by the Charlotte Observer, and he alleges that the party has been gripped by McCarthyism. Is there a real split emerging right now in the Republican Party? I mean, I think about some of the reports I even seen today about the Georgia primary race that's going on right now between Brian Kemp and David Perdue. And it just looks like the party is fractured, and that fracture might even be expanded.
I think there certainly is that issue. And I think it's happened ever since Donald Trump emerged as the nominee in 2016. There always have been some people who have been against that. I think as the campaign moved forward in 2016, most of those folks were put to the side. But I think as time went on, there were some who were fine with President Trump, were happy to support his policies, but then were not too sad when he left the stage in 2020 and kind of wanted to move on, versus the people who want the former president to continue to play not only sort of an advisory role, but either to be the nominee again or to be the kingmaker. I mean, there have been a lot of candidates, including some of the ones in North Carolina, who were candidates and successful candidates because they went down to Mar-a-Lago, talked to President Trump and his people, and got the endorsement. You mentioned your friend, the former Congressman Mark Walker. Mark Walker went down there and was part of a discussion at the time where the former president wanted Mark Walker to drop out of the Senate race and run for the U.S. House again. And he was going to give an endorsement. The former president was going to give an endorsement to Mark Walker for a House race. The election districts didn't end up turning out to be very well for that prospect. And former Congressman Walker also said that he just didn't end up wanting to take that deal. Mm-hmm. But there have been a lot of cases, not just in North Carolina, but nationwide, where the president is playing this kingmaking role. And I think there are some folks within the Republican Party who, though they appreciate the things that Donald Trump did, appreciate him in his role in bringing some people into the party who hadn't been there before, who would kind of like him to now take on a different role and not necessarily be the power broker in the party moving forward. And I think until that gets resolved, you are going to see a lot of these conflicts between the Trump wing and the not necessarily anti-Trump, but beyond Trump wing.
No, I definitely think you're right. I think some people are just ready for it to all go away. You know, the former president is actually outraising the entire Republican Party. So, I mean, he's raising more money than the entire party. And and he's endorsing candidates all up and down the ballot. I mean, right even to insurance commissioner. I've seen some endorsements. So, I mean, it's unprecedented for a former president to weigh into the election cycle, I think, as deeply and heavily as the former president has. And has now even triggered former Vice President Mike Pence to come out and start campaigning down in Georgia. So this is going to be an interesting fight, I think, not only through November, but an interesting fight as we lead up to 2024. I guess to bring it back home a little bit, there was a WRAL story already previewing the fight that we're going to see here in 2024, most likely between Attorney General Josh Stein and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. And they highlighted just the amount of money these guys have already raised. And I think Stein is even outraised Robinson at this point. And they are predicting you're going to see a tremendous amount of outside money come into the state. I'm sure you're going to see the former president come in and weigh in on this race as well. You know, Mitch, we just gotten to a point where if you want to be in elected office, you're going to need a ton of money.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think that's true nationwide, but especially true in North Carolina, because we are such a state that can turn things one way or the other for the major parties. Now, of course, the governor's race is not one that's going to have an impact on what happens on Capitol Hill, but it is an important role. It is an important potential stepping stone. We know that our current governor, Roy Cooper, has been listed in some places as a potential presidential candidate, even. I don't know how serious. I don't know how serious that is, but I certainly think he would be looked at as a vice presidential candidate for any Democrat running, because you have to look at his success winning two races for the governor's office in a state that can go red, perhaps a little bit more often than it goes blue. And if you're a Democratic candidate, looking at North Carolina, looking at its electoral votes, looking at Roy Cooper's relative success, you have to see him as a potential a national figure. So this is a seat that's going to be very important. And then when you look at the U.S. Senate, of course, because the state can vote either for Republicans or Democrats, both parties are going to be looking at this as a potential place to win. As folks are looking at who controls the U.S. House, and you see close battles between Republicans and Democrats there, this is another state where there are potential to flip some seats here and there, unlike other states that are very deeply blue or very deeply red because we're so purple. I think, as you suggested, if you're going to be running for a major office in North Carolina, you're definitely going to need to have some money behind you. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this race of 2024, you suggested that we already kind of know who the major candidates are. Now, on the Democratic side, I've heard no other name than Josh Stein, which is very rare at this point. You'd say, okay, you think Josh Stein's going to be the front runner, but maybe there are some other candidates who serve on the Council of State or are leading legislators or a mayor or some, you know, maybe even a large business figure who's a potential candidate. But I've heard no other names than Josh Stein. On the Republican side, Mark Robertson seems to be the front runner. I've heard that potentially State Treasurer Dale Falwell might want to get in on the race. And if it turns out that we have one side, the Democratic side, with no major contest, while the other side, the Republican side, has a hard-fought primary, that, of course, won't necessarily be great for the Republicans. Democrats would love to see that happen. Yeah, and so it'll be very interesting to see what happens going forward.
Yeah, I've heard as well that Treasurer Falwell might be positioned to get in that race. I will tell you, I've known Treasurer Falwell since he was in the House, and he lives here in Winston-Salem in my backyard. So we used to have breakfast at the Piedmont Club pretty often. And his campaign style, I wonder if after this primary election day, he might be reevaluating whether or not he wants to get in that race. I just don't know if his campaign style fits with where the party has landed. And obviously 2024 is a long way from here, especially in politics. So a lot can change between now and then. But I just question if the way he likes to campaign, and, you know, he's very matter of the fact, he's all about policy conversations. And it just feels like that's not really where the party is at the moment. It's a little bit more of a popularity contest, in my opinion. When we think about Lieutenant Governor Robertson, he was able to get into Raleigh on a viral moment. You know, he gave a speech to city council, went viral on YouTube. I know several people, including people in my own circle, that had no idea who he was prior to the video, but literally voted for him just based on the video because they felt like he was right for North Carolina. You and I both know, as Lieutenant Governor, you have very little power, really hard to push through any substantive policy. I think Dan Forrest actually set a really great example of how to make a lot of noise as Lieutenant Governor, despite not having a lot of power. Is Mark Robertson ready to be governor of North Carolina?
That's a very good question. And unfortunately for him, the Lieutenant Governor's role doesn't really give him a good opportunity to prove one way or another how good he is at this. This is basically because of changes made to the Lieutenant Governor's office back in the Jim Gardner days. It's very much just a bully pulpit role. He gets to run sessions of the state Senate based on rules that are set by the leaders within the Senate itself. And then he gets to serve on some important boards like the State Board of Education. But for the most part, most of his work is just bringing attention to issues that are important to him, like setting up that FACTS task force so that parents could report on things that they didn't like seeing in their school system's instruction. So that's really what he's going to be able to do between now and a run for the governor's office. But as you well know, being a governor involves more than just calling out the issues that you are interested in. You have to set up a team that's going to be able to run all these various government departments. You have to have a team that's going to be able to put together a good budget and manage what budget the General Assembly comes up with. You have to be a good negotiator with the General Assembly. That's something that for the most part, this current governor, Roy Cooper, has decided not to do. I think given his position as a former legislator for many years and having to work with the General Assembly as Attorney General, I think he could have chosen to do a lot more cooperation with the General Assembly. But instead, partly because of his choice, partly because of the legislator's choice, they tried to take away a bunch of his powers right after he was elected. It has ended up being a much more antagonistic role. But I think, especially if Republicans maintain controls, and certainly if they get supermajorities again in the General Assembly, if Mark Robinson were to be governor, one of his roles would have to be having a good relationship with the General Assembly, trying to find ways that they can work together. And that's just something he hasn't had to do a lot of. That doesn't say he can't do it. It just says it's not something that he has really had to do much as lieutenant governor. And it's not something that he's really going to have to do much over the next couple of years, I don't think either. So I think people who like Mark Robinson now largely like him because they like the things that he talks about. They like the fact that he comes across as a really down-to-earth person. And like so many people who have won elections in recent years, he doesn't come across as this politician who is just decided to go for the next job, and then they say what they have to say so they can win the next job, and then they say what they have to say to win the next job. Mark Robinson, as we know, says what he thinks and doesn't really care too much if people don't like what he says, because he believes it wholeheartedly, and he's going to say it regardless of whether he's lieutenant governor or not.
Yeah, he also refers to Democrats as the enemy. And so I'm wondering if there's a lot of motivation there to sit down with the enemy, as you talked about, and actually try to negotiate substantive policy. So I question that. I love the point that you made about having a successful team around you. And I don't want my audience to miss that, because that is very critical to being successful in that position. You've got to have really great policy people around you that know how to go down and work with legislators and the General Assembly to actually get something done. And I'd also question with some of the tough attacks that the lieutenant governor has lobbed on the former governor, McCrory. I don't think a lot of those people that were on the policy team for McCrory are going to be dying to get back to Raleigh in 2024 to work for Mark Robinson. So I do see some challenges out there for us, or for Robinson, as we lead into 2024. Last thing real quick, Mitch, because I'm pretty much out of time, but I want to work in this last question. You spend so much time in Raleigh. The session just kicked off. What can my audience look for? What are the top three things you're watching this upcoming session?
Well, the first thing is not actually a piece of legislation, but I think look at the timeline and the fact that almost everyone involved in this session wants it to be short. That last long session was the longest one in history. And I think legislators don't want to spend months and months and months here. So really look for a session that lasts, some are saying as short as 6 weeks, but I think most people think that's wishful thinking. It'll probably be at least a couple of months, but not very far into the summer. Second big thing will be, what do they do on budget adjustments? The governor signed into law a budget last November, but he wants to spend about 8.5% more with his budget adjustments because of the $6 billion in additional funding that was unexpected, or additional revenue that was unexpected, that the General Assembly and the governor have to work with. I think there will be an increase that the General Assembly will agree to, but it won't be the size that the governor wants. So look to see what happens with the budget. I think that will include some additional raises, maybe even some additional tax relief. But so that's important. And then I think the third big thing is there are some issues that are of interest that might get a hearing, but it'll probably depend on how much time legislators really want to spend working them out. Medicaid expansion, legalization in some form of marijuana use. Probably if it happens, it would be for medical marijuana, not recreational marijuana. Sports wagering, that's something that's been talked about. Wow. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about this Parents' Bill of Rights, which is something that we at the John Locke Foundation have touted, and we know that legislative leaders are also interested in. So that would be my third thing, is all of these issues that are going to take more than just a day or two to work out, Will legislators really want to spend time on them, or will they say, this is a good idea to save for 2023 when we've got a lot more time to work on this?
Mitch, I appreciate you locking in, and I'm almost certain my audience listening to us this conversation sees exactly why I wanted to get you on the show, because you're a wealth of knowledge, not only in our own backyard here in North Carolina, but even with some of these national issues that we're wrestling with in Washington. So I really appreciate you doing this. To my audience, the other voice that you've heard joining me today is Mitch Kocha, who is the senior political analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He does write regularly for the Carolina Journal. I read the Carolina Journal religiously, so I would encourage you to follow the Carolina Journal, not just for Mitch, but they've got a lot of great content if you want to learn more about what's happening around the state of North Carolina. And as always, I encourage you to make sure you stay tuned to WTOB every Sunday morning. That's where the Locked In Show broadcasts. But if you happen to miss it, you can always subscribe and download the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Pandora. Wherever your favorite podcast is, you can lock in with me there. Make sure you're always following Algernon Cash on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WCG. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. The views and opinions in this podcast are solely those of the contributors and are not necessarily those of our distributors or hosting company. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.